Thanks to Nish and Juan for giving me the opportunity to present this work here. So as the title suggests, I'll talk about a new method of detecting a stochastic gravitational wave background and analyzing it, which is very promising in the way that we are thinking that it might actually advance the detection of stochastic gravitational wave background in maybe the next few years or something like that. So to begin with, we are very familiar with probably this plot or the fact that LIGO detected more than 100 individual GW merger signals. But the thing is, all of the detections that LIGO made, so the main property of the signal was that these were all the waveforms could be resolved individually, and they appeared coherent as like individual events for the detector. So that's why LIGO could see them as individual events and claim this as detection. But based on, let's say, the expected merger rate for gravitational waves or the star formation rate and things like that, one can say that this is not the complete picture. There are way many more gravitational wave signals which are sub-threshold probably that LIGO cannot detect, but these events are there. So a rough estimate would be that there is probably one merger in 200 to 300 seconds. I don't know, I might be a bit outdated with the number. It might have changed, but I think in the last year or so, that was approximately the number. So what can one learn from these sub-threshold events? Or is there any way that even you can detect these things? So that is one of the questions that is there in the astrophysical community or the gravitational wave community. So that leads to the stochastic gravitational wave background. So before anything, I'd like to just present a few, just a brief introduction to the stochastic gravitational wave background. So you can imagine all these sub-threshold events which the detector, the LIGO or any gravitational wave detector cannot resolve individually. They are still there, but submerged way like orders of magnitude in the noise, so you cannot resolve them. But you can still compute the power spectrum from them, or you can take a very long stretch of, let's say, the strain data, and you can do a cross-correlation and actually compute how much extra power you have in that data because of these sub-threshold events. So that kind of leads to the astrophysical stochastic gravitational wave background. Now, it's important that this is like the astrophysical stochastic background, which is slightly different from the cosmological one, which originally arises as a stochastic process. But the astrophysical stochastic background is different in the way that you can interpret this more as a limitation of the detector rather than actually the generation process. Now, to actually quantify this background, you can usually, like in the literature, you would use the spectrum. Like you can compute the spectrum, which is given in this expression. And not going into the details of all the terms, you guys might be familiar with this, but just that there are three different aspects of the stochastic background that contributes to the final the signal or the final detection statistics or whatever you can call it. So there is the astrophysical part, which depends on the star formation rate, the merger rate, or the distribution of the black holes, which is this term R. I don't know if you can see the cursor. Probably no. Okay.
Disappeared?
Yeah, like when I mirrored it, disappeared. I don't know. Anyways. And there's another term, which is the GW source term, so which takes into account the gravitational wave flux in particular here. And then you have the cosmological term, which kind of dictates how this stochastic background basically propagates through the universe and how this is like present in the background there. So this is pretty much similar to what you can, it's pretty much similar to, let's say, CMB or other background you can have. But the question is, how do you detect this? Usually for any kind of background field or any, these kind of background signal that is present, you would define our detection statistics. So this is the traditional way I'm talking about, that how you quantify and detect the stochastic gravitational background. So you can define a detection statistics based on just multiplication of the two strains. And then you can define a signal-to-noise ratio computed from this detection statistic. So you compute the mean and the variance of S over here. And you can, from this, you can say that this is the excess power, like excess cross-correlation power that is present in the background. So you can estimate, like analytically, you can estimate what the background is based on this omega GW. And then you can express the signal-to-noise ratio in terms of this that omega GW as well. But the primary assumptions of this particular analysis is that you assume that the signal is Gaussian, like the background signal is Gaussian, and also it's stationary. So usually you would just assume it as some power law, as a function of frequency with some index, and you can try to like do various things like parameter estimation based on indexing of that power law or what the values are in each frequency bins and so on and so forth. Now, one fact about this particular analysis is that our present like GW detector setup is that if you look at the distance between, let's say, Livingston and Hanford. So you can have a maximum time delay of 10 milliseconds between two individual events or between the two signals that the detector would actually detect. And this time delay actually kills a lot of SNR or the sensitivity of detecting the background if you go at higher frequencies. So higher meaning more than 30 hertz or in fact 25 hertz. So 25 hertz would be the peak detectability frequency for the background, but it slowly goes down after that. So the SNR goes down after that. Now, So the next question is, so what are the limitations or what can we do better given that we have this background and we have a way to detect that or a formalism to detect that, but what can we do better? So to even before asking that question, it's better first to understand that exactly what is the nature of the signal we are talking about. So as I said, that you would usually do a power spectrum analysis. So you can just imagine that there are multiple subthreshold events. So when you're computing the cross correlation based on the detection statistics I showed, you can imagine that it's basically just taking different segments and summing over the power of the signal that is there. And you're just computing how much excess power is there. So that works for a continuous gravitational wave signal really well, because you expect, like, it is intrinsically Gaussian. But as I was mentioning, that the astrophysical stochastic background is not intrinsically Gaussian. Or in another language, if you look at the duty cycle from these plots, which were present in Shubhadip Mukherjee and Silk's paper, you can see that the duty cycle is pretty low for, let's say, even 30, 40 hertz. Also, based on the present merger rates, you can say that the signal doesn't overlap. So if you take into account these individual subthreshold merger events, so they do not overlap like at 20 hertz or at 30 hertz. Maybe they overlap at like very low frequencies, but we are not interested for our present detector setup at those low frequencies. So this changes the story or changes the picture a little bit. Now we have this sort of popcorn kind of a signal, or you can think it's like Poisson distributed instead of just like being Gaussian. And this additionally brings another fact that now the stochastic background is not completely stationary if you take into account this non-overlapping nature. So there would be some time dependence there as well, because here actually like individual events are kind of overlapping there. So this brings the next question, that the detection statistics that that is defined or that LIGO also uses for the detection. So is that like enough for this particular setup of stochastic background or this particular form of the signal? So to understand that even more, you can actually consider another fact, that the gravitational wave signals like that are present in this stream of signal, they have a typical chirping nature, which you can see. I mean, this is just like a illustration of the time frequency characteristics of the individual signals. But once you say that the signal is non-overlapping, even if it's like embedded deep within the noise, this chirp nature would still be preserved. So this becomes more important, not in a time domain analysis, but if you're looking at the time frequency domain analysis, you can actually see that these chirp patterns are completely present over there. So another thing that additionally you can say once you say that the chirp pattern is like preserved in each of the signal is that you can have additional frequency correlations which would actually depend on time. So you can imagine that if you take two a chirp and you just overlap them, you do a cross correlation, but not just in one direction, but in time and frequency. So you can have frequency correlation that actually varies with time. So usually in the power spectrum analysis, these things are not taken into account. I mean, you do not take into account these frequency correlations where, of course, there is additional information present, but you would just take into account the power over there in a way. But what we are suggesting now is that if you do this cross-correlation analysis in time frequency domain with spectrograms, then actually you can address these issues. So firstly, you can take into account the excess information that is present because of these frequency correlations. And additionally, you can also take into account the additional information that you can get from the signal because of these chirping nature. So that leads to our technique of analyzing and detecting a stochastic gravitational wave background, which is a spectrogram correlated stacking. Okay. So so this is probably the only like technical slide I would present, just to give the overall picture, like how this overall method works. So first, you can start with the strain from two detectors, which is shown at the top. Then you have to compute the spectrogram of this, which is done by a short time Fourier transform for our approach. And once you have the spectrogram of these two strains, you can then compute the cross-correlation of that and get a time frequency domain cross-correlation. Now that leads to an additional problem. Like when you're computing the cross-correlation of spectrograms, so spectrograms are, as you can see, it's a positive definite quantity, which is given by the square of the wavelet transform or the short-time Fourier transform, whatever. So the cross-correlation for the noise won't get canceled, so it would still be there. So the estimator that we are saying that you would get just by cross-correlating two spectrograms is unbiased, because the noise contribution would not get canceled out over there. So that leads to the next part of the problem, that how we can actually subtract the noise, or how we can actually extract the signal from this cross-correlation. So there is an interesting observation over here that even though we are claiming that the signal is non-Gaussian or it's Poisson distributed because of this non-overlapping nature, noise is still stationary. Like the signal is time-dependent, non-Gaussian, whatever, but the noise is stationary over here. So if you look at the cross-correlation plot here, I mean, I'll come to this later, but just to see, or maybe I can just draw it on the board, it's easier for everyone to see. So let's say I have a cross-correlation plane here in terms of delta F and delta T, which are the time and frequency lag. So usually when you cross-correlate two signals, so let's say this is the origin, and this is the origin here. So usually the signal would peak, let's say, close to this zero. Now, for a gravitational wave signal, it won't be exactly at zero. I mean, it would be at zero, but there would be a certain spread because of the chirping nature, because you have different frequency bins getting correlated with other ones at different times. So for let's say I do not have noise, I just have the signal, so I would get a spread like this here. Now, interestingly, for noise, the LIGO noise, whatever we have, it's colored noise. So of course there would be some frequency correlation for the noise, but the interesting thing is that you won't have any delta t dependence for the noise cross correlation. So in this plane, whatever little fluctuation you have, like sitting on top of the central signal part, so that is basically coming from the noise. And interestingly, you can say that if you are moving away from this delta t delta f equals to zero or nearby zero region, so the noise contribution is always the same because noise is stationary over. So it won't depend on how, like where you are in the delta t plane. So that is the next part of our statistics, where we actually extract the signal by sampling a different cross correlation from this plane. So let's say we have a small aperture of a certain width, and we just randomly sample like the cross correlation value from all over this delta f delta t plane, leaving just this region because we know that all the signal contribution is from there. Now, if you sample these small noise contributions from there, so it's basically this p background distribution that you have over there. And once you have this noise background distribution, you can subtract it from the entire cross correlation that you can get, and that should effectively give you the signal part, which is the p clean part here. So this particular cross correlation plot that is shown over here, the 3D plot, so this is for the subtracted one. I mean, if you have noise, like if you do not do the subtraction, it would just be an overall disturbance. You won't see this like thing peaking at delta t delta f equals to zero. But interestingly, or like based on the statistics of the noise, once you do the subtraction, actually the signal comes out from this this thing. Now, so now we have understanding that how this signal actually manifests in the cross correlation delta t delta f plane. So what do we do with it next? So we want to marginalize this over delta t because, as I said, for the chirping nature, you have like a particular delta f dependence in the cross correlation, which you don't want to kill off, or which might have like more interesting information that you can study or do, let's say, parameter estimation or those kind of things. So you actually marginalize over delta t by taking a small window again, because in delta t also there would be a small spread for the signal as well. So you marginalize over that, and then the last plot that is shown over there, so that kind of gives you the cross correlation as a function of just delta f. So once again, you can see the peak more clearly. So these are just illustrative plots. I'll show the actual plots with our simulated data later. But once you have this kind of the contribution of the cross correlation near the delta f equals to zero, then you can go on computing the SNR for this particular signal, which is given by this rho p over here. So again, I'll discuss the computation of the SNR in more details. So that's the basic workflow or the way this method works. Now to test and verify that, okay, like we made some claims that you can actually extract extra information using this statistics compared to, let's say, the usual traditional cross-correlation statistics, or that this takes into account the chirping nature of the signal, and so on and so forth. So we actually simulated mock GW, two sets of mock GW signal, and then did a comparative study, and also looked at all the characteristics of this particular statistics. So just for testing purpose, we have a simulated stochastic gravitational wave background signal with a very high merger rate. Now, this is done just to show that this method works, or just to make life easier and like make coding easier to see how this is working. So we injected around 10,000 individual events, which are very low in SNR. So I mean, the SNR distribution of the events are like this. So you can see it's like close to the, I think the mean was around like 1.7 or something. So it's very, it's way less than what LIGO would typically detect as individual events. So this is the SNR distribution of the 10,000 events, and we injected. I think it's around 8, something, right? If I'm not wrong. Yeah, so then we are not working with LIGO noise over here because of glitches, so I'll come to that part later. But we took the PhD of the O3 observation run and generated streams of synthetic LIGO noise where we injected these signals. So the first for dataset one, it's basically in 30,000 seconds we injected these 10,000 waveforms, and for dataset two, which is closer to, let's say, what you would expect, not entirely close to what you would expect, but it's like around 500,000 seconds having these 10,000 waveforms on second. So yeah, I mean, these are like the two data sets that we are kind of taking, and the mass ranges were from 10 to 90. And for the distance, it was around 6,000 to 30,000 megaparsec. So that would be around, I think, 3.8 or something in terms of redshift, like the maximum redshift. So I mean, this maximum redshift is interesting or important here because I think the star formation rate peaks at around z equals to 2. So that's where you would expect most of the stochastic background contribution to come from. So this just says that we have covered that particular like region. So anyway, so I showed this in our plot. Okay, now we have the formalism, we have a mock data set to test with. So how does spec actually work with this real data set? Okay, so the first step is to actually compute the spectrogram of these. I'm sure like people are well familiar with how gravitational wave signals spectrograms look. So the first one shows, again, these are all I'm showing these things for data set one. So that's why they're like way more closer to each other. But in the time frequency domain, just for the signal, the spectrogram would look like this. And for noise, as you can see, it's just, of course, random fluctuations over there. Now, for doing this analysis, so I said like we have 30,000 seconds for one data set, 500,000 seconds for one data set. Now, usually you cannot just correlate the entire thing in any computer, basically. So this is also done in case of the time domain analysis that LIGO usually do. So they would segment this long like years or months of data into very smaller segments. So here we are taking segments of 500 seconds, and we are computing the cross-correlation of each of these segments and stacking that for whatever time we have, like whatever is the total length of the data set. The other advantage, I would say, for this analysis is that you can actually crop the spectrograms because this is like a 2D array. So of course, you can have memory issues or if you take a very long data stream, then of course this stacks would grow a lot in terms of memory. So you can crop the spectrograms for a frequency beyond which you're not interested in. So for a stochastic background, anyways, like high frequency in terms of like LIGO's detectability is not important. So we cropped the spectrograms for 640 hertz. And once you compute the cross-correlation, do the subtraction, the background subtraction. So this is how the cross-correlation would actually look for dataset one. So you can see a very prominent peak in the delta T delta F region. But even more interestingly, you can actually see the spread in the delta F plane that comes from the chirping nature of the signal. And once you marginalize this over delta T, so the plot on the right, that shows how exactly the delta F behavior of this is. So yeah, that plot is shown one with like a noise in the background, like with injections after doing the subtraction. And the other one is just for the signal to see like how much our subtraction is kind of getting, you know, like getting rid of the signal, or how well this subtraction formalism that we said, like this expression shown in the bottom, this P clean equals to PCC minus P back. So how well this actually estimates it. So yeah, I mean, of course, there is a bit of loss of signal as well coming from this background subtraction, but it's not like very significant in like at least in our opinion. Okay, so this all goes for the signal part of the picture when it comes to our specs analysis. Now, what other like thing can we talk about the noise distribution as well? Because here, as I mentioned, that we are actually sampling different like apertures throughout the plane. So basically, you have a whole statistics of noise as well. So what else can you do with it, or how does it look, or what can you do about that? So we assumed, I mean, we are not taking into account any glitches or anything in this particular analysis that we are showing. So noise is Gaussian for us. And you can see from this sampling of the noise, like these P apertures. So this is how the noise distribution looks at different delta F. So here it's Gaussian, and you can very prominently see that. But the interesting thing is that you have a like it's not just how, I mean, we have something more than just the spectrum of the noise. So you actually have a distribution with which you can do other things, not just compute the mean, but you can compute the you can like do other things with this distribution for subtracting the noise. Even let's say if there are glitches present, or if it's non-Gaussian, or yeah, so for non-stationary noise and things like that. And compared to just for our particular mock data set, the red line shows where the signal is after the subtraction. So you can see that even like though the gravitational wave signal was buried like around 4 or 5 orders of magnitude within noise, but after doing the subtraction, you can see that at different delta F, it stands out in a way, like in this particular method. Okay, so I said that you actually have a distribution, like you can do different statistics with the noise over here, because we have this P background, which is basically a set of all the apertures that we sampled from here. Now, usually for, again, like the usual cross-correlation analysis, the way you would compute the SNR is by just taking the mean and dividing it by the variance of the statistic. But that is not, again, the complete picture, because noise can have frequency correlation as well, as I said, because we are using noise having a particular PSD, or this is colored noise. So of course, you have to like take that into account in some way. And here, this is just the plot of the covariance matrix of the noise statistics that we get from these apertures, like this distribution. And this is how the covariance matrix looks. And it's very evident that it's not completely, I mean, it's diagonal, but you can see that there are non-zero of diagonal terms present as well, which shows that noise is correlated at other frequencies. Like there is frequency correlation for the noise. So the reason why I'm showing the covariance matrix is because we eventually, when we are computing the SNR, we are not just doing mean by variance, but we are actually computing it using the covariance matrix, which is the total picture in a way, which gives the correct covariance metric, which gives the correct SNR for like this kind of signal and noise. And yeah, so on top, this is the expression, the full expression of the SNR that we are computing. So C inverse is basically inverse of the covariance matrix, and P sig are basically the marginalized cross-correlation around the P that showed. So for data set one, we get a SNR of around 8. And for data set two, we get a SNR of around 4. And the fluctuations you see are basically just from the noise. So of course, data set two was for 500,000 seconds. I mean, you can do like you can extend it way more, and the SNR would build up slowly. So that is the expectation. And I'll show a few plots later on related to that. But this plot just clearly shows that how our statistic, like the specs statistics that we are proposing, is sensitive to the signal, or how it can detect the signal. Now, usually for the LVH detectors, you would combine baselines, meaning you would do cross-correlation between. So if you have three detectors, you can cross-correlate the signal between like pairs of two detectors, and then you can combine the baselines, like the SNR that you can get using like just adding in quadrature. And we did this for like including the Virgo detector as well, like the previous ones that I was showing. So they were just based on a noise generated using PSD of LIGO for Livingston and Hanford. But this plot shows what happens if you include the Virgo detector as well. So you can see that from 8.1, it increases to 8.7. Like there's a slight increase as expected. But of course, it's not a lot because Virgo is like way less sensitive than the other two detectors. But this shows that usually, like the usual notion that combining baselines increases the SNR, so that still like holds here in a good way. You mean this plot? Yeah. So it's basically you take a small delta t dependence. So again, like the signal would not be just present at delta t. So there would be a little, I mean, the signal would not just be present at delta t equals to zero, but there would be a small spread. So if you like, if I zoom in to this region, you can see, you'd probably see that there is a small spread over here. So for our data set here, that spread was around 2 milliseconds, like in delta t. So we took a 2 millisecond window, which kind of covers this peak, and we averaged the cross-correlation over that 2 millisecond range, like over this window. And the plot on the right that you see is basically the result of that. No, so the maximum was, I think there were like few events which were of like SNR more than 8, but like most of it was just around 2-1, around that. Yeah, there were a few like around 8-9 range, but there were like I think like 10 or 15 events out of like the. So I mean, you're saying that like the final SNR that I showed around 8, like why it's more than the individual events that I'm showing here, if I understand the question correctly, or. Oh, because, okay, so let's say if you have a SNR of 20, like one event having SNR of 20 in like the whole like data set, so your variance would be way like high, right? Because you're taking into account a very large like length of data there. So that would like suppress the like one like event that stands out, so that would suppress the SNR of that. SNR of that event, like when you're doing the analysis for a very long time integration, like a very long
Maybe one way to understand
time length.
this here, we assume you know the parameters and the template perfectly. So there is no parameter uncertainty, and then this is the uncertainty amplitude. But then if you don't know the parameters, when the event happens, and what are all the major parameters, then your SNR also, you have a marginal algorithm, and then that basically dilutes it. So you cannot really detect. If you know exactly when the event happens, it could have a high SNR, but if you don't know when it happens, then you have to average of all the possibilities and then decrease the SNR.
Yeah, and this average is over like whatever time length we are choosing for the signal, basically, for
But
the
if you
stochastic signal.
combine all of these, then in principle the SNR could increase quite a bit, but then also you have many more unknown parameters. So that's kind of where it's uncertain. So, I mean, your best possible SNR is the sum of all of these SNRs.
Yeah, that's like the theoretical maximum you can have. So, which is like probably around, it's around 100 or something. No. So there are like, okay, so if you're talking about the actual, so here we had control over like whatever the maximum SNR was or if there were glitches or not, whatever. So if you actually think about the real data stream, so let's say you have glitches or you have events that kind of stands out over there. So the ideally you would window those high SNR events and just take into account events that are not like detectable or that are not like prominent in the data stream, and then you can just go on doing the usual, like the cross-correlation spectrogram analysis that we are saying. So, high SNR events, like let's say like mid-range SNR events, let's say 5 or 6, so they would of course contribute more to the detection statistics, but just based on the merger rates and based on the astrophysical parameters, you can think that the SNR would peak at around like 2 or somewhere around that, like less than 2, like for majority of the events. So most of the contribution to the stochastic background would actually come from SNR between 1 and 2. And of course, you're marginalizing over the different segments which has this event, so it goes on like getting added here. Yeah, but yeah, as you're saying, like you can always window a very large SNR event and take that out of the picture, because one might say that okay, like that might have a way larger contribution to, let's say, the SNR plots I was showing, the SNR 8 or whatever you get, but you can like get rid of those events in a way. But I think
SNR sometimes can be misleading.
Mm-hmm.
They can always plot if you have this random noise, like this background on the detector with no signal, you can plot the distribution of SNR. Right? So let's say if you set the card SNR equal 8, what is the likelihood that the detector will generate a fake signal with this SNR?
Mm-hmm.
From this the residual probability, so now you have your own definition of SNR. Have you used, for example, data? Let's say you displace the LIGO data by 10 seconds or 100 seconds. So in that case, you know that there is no signal that
mm-hmm.
overlapping time. Have you tested your SNR statistics using this kind of algorithm?
For the actual LIGO data, no, because the only thing that stopped us from doing that were glitches. So we were getting like high spurious SNR values over there. And once we looked at the whitened data stream, we could see like these glitches like individually there. Now, one might say that, okay, glitches are present just in one detector, not they won't be correlated, so they should not contribute to the correlation. But the problem we faced over here was that since we are doing it for spectrograms, so the glitches were not getting canceled out in a way, like for, like, you know, like one like glitch present in one detector was not getting canceled out for like another detector not having a glitch. The residual SNR that you're talking about, I think like this fluctuations that you see up to like 3 or like in this range, so that's kind of the residual SNR coming from noise. But that's like the next part of the project, or like that's the next follow-up we are trying to work on, is to actually do this with O3 data, but windowing these glitches or any loud events that would be present there. The other thing I want to say over here, like it's complicated to read too much into the exact values of the SNRs here, as you're saying, because of the residual ones. So this is also like an open question for us, that how to exactly interpret this value, like this SNR of 8 that we are showing over here. So this is not, let's say, just for the signal, because you can see that just for noise also you would have a contribution. So should we like subtract this, or what kind of statistics one should do to actually understand this SNR? So that's like the next questions probably we are interested in.
Yeah,
as well.
Just try to compute this get the statistics.
Are you thinking about p-value?
No.
This is just, I mean, the ratio of the,
this is just one statistical observable, right? So you can get the, you can compute this for enough samples of the background. And then you get the distribution of this row with the background. You know that there's no signal.
Oh, okay, you're saying just to do random realization by shifting the data stream. Okay, yeah. Okay, and for data set two, so this also answers your question. So these two are for the exact same 10,000 waveforms, but one was injected in 30,000 seconds and another was injected in 500,000 seconds. So you can see the SNR going down for the second data set because it's just spread over a way longer time. So that changes the covariance of the statistics in a way. Okay, so yeah, so as I was saying that for data set one, that's like just for testing purpose, for like verifying what we are doing here, and data set two is like more closer, not exactly close to what you would expect, but still like way closer than how data set one would behave. And interestingly, this is how the SNR builds up as you take longer time integration or as you take like more number of events. So there is like a small open question here as well, that for the cross-correlation analysis, usually this would scale as the square root of integration time t. But here we are not exactly sure about how the SNR scales with like t, but here this plot, that's why we took into account like just the number of events in a way. Like you can see that if you increase the number of events injected in noise, so this is how the SNR builds up. But anyways, we are not like talking about the time dependence too much here. Okay, so one of the main like claims that we made was that this statistics like specs can extract more information from the signal. So in this plot, it's like this is like the main plot, I would say, in a way. So this shows that for data set one, we did the analysis as LIGO would do, taking into account optimal estimator, like a Wiener filtered estimator, optimal estimator. And this is how the orange line shows how the SNR would behave as like a function of frequency. So we took different cutoff frequencies and computed the SNR till that. And the blue line on top shows what happens for specs. So it's very evident that for the same signal using these two different methods, like the orange one being the standard cross-correlation method that LIGO uses versus the one that we are using, that you can have 8 times gain in SNR. Now, just mind you that these are, like one might say that, okay, like you have a SNR of close to 10, but in the plots I showed SNR of 8. So the reason is that this we are doing just for the signal. We don't want, we wanted to remove any bias for different noise realizations. So that's why this is just, we wanted to get the exact factor by which you are gaining in SNR, or by which, let's say, this method works better in a way. So we just took the signal, did not inject them in noise, but of course the covariance matrix is computed using the noise, just the noise. So yeah, so this is like the main, I would say, the result that we gained around 8 times in SNR, at least for this particular data, mock data that we are showing. So what is the implication of this 8 times gain? So this is the latest plot from the O3 stochastic background paper by the LIGO-Virgo collaboration, and you can see that the cyan and the blue lines are the estimated power spectrum that you can compute based on star formation rate and different models of like flux for the gravitational wave. And it's of course just based on O3, there were no claims of actually detect section of the stochastic background, but they just could give an upper bound on that, which is basically this dotted line above the blue dotted line. But if we claim that our method... This is the O3. That is the dotted one is the designed sensitivity. So I want to say that even like with the design sensitivity, you could just like make the upper bound, or you can just bound the stochastic background in a better way based on the usual cross-correlation analysis. But if we are claiming that there can be a possible 8 times gain in SNR based on our method, so that sensitivity would go down way into the regime where you can actually have the stochastic gravitational background signal. So yeah, this would be like the big claim of our work, that in principle, if this 8 times SNR gain is true, then you can actually detect the stochastic gravitational wave background based on the present estimates of the background and based on the design sensitivity of the detectors. I don't want to go into details of this plot. So basically, to conclude, the take-home message would be that this spectrogram-based correlation analysis is firstly sensitive to the time dependence of the gravitational wave background signal. It takes into account the non-Gaussian aspect of the signal, because this is actually a higher order statistics. This is not just like second order as you would do for the usual cross-correlation one, because this is like fourth order statistics. So it takes into account the non-Gaussianity. The other important part is that it actually is sensitive to the chirping nature of the signal, so it takes into account the frequency correlations, and from there you can like get more information. Now, the other, like other than actually making this work with the actual LIGO data, getting like filtering the glitches and everything, the other important aspect of our work, which is ongoing now, is how we can do actually parameter estimation using this method. So you can usually, the way you would do parameter estimation is try to fit different templates based on this blue line, because let's say you change the star formation rate, you change metallicity, or you change the merger rate, so this blue line would like move a bit, so that's why you have this uncertainty here, which is shown in cyan. So usually you would do a template fitting of the stochastic background just based on the power spectrum, but now we have like more information in a way that we have another way to quantify the parameters based on this delta F delta T correlation as well. Or even if you're not talking about delta T correlations, just the plots I was showing for delta F. So that's another way of actually trying to fit what parameter estimations you can do, or like fit a template based on that. So that is another extra thing that we gain from our work. Yeah, thank you.
Questions for Ami?
So, thanks for the nice talk. So, you were mentioning this problem with glitches. The non-Gaussian nature of that being the problems. Can you say a little bit more about what you have in mind for trying to address that?
So LIGO would face the same problem while analyzing the stochastic background signal. So what they would do is just add like a 2-key window or something of appropriate width. So if I just in time domain, let's say I have the strain like this, and then you can have like glitches standing out here. So what they do is actually just multiply this with a window and just get rid of this. So you lose a bit of the signal, but these window lengths would be of like few milliseconds probably, like of the order of like 2 or even less, like 1 or 2 milliseconds. And you can get rid of the glitches in this way. So one of the reason why still we are like trying to figure out how exactly this works for the entire, let's say O3 data of few months, is if we can automate this in some way, like if we can actually put a threshold and get rid of all the glitches, because of course, like if you whiten the data, you can see the glitches manually, but it's impossible to like go through months of data and get rid of all the glitches. But usually this is the way that's done, just multiplying the stream with a, like just even before computing the spectrogram or anything, just take the time series data, whiten it, and just window the glitches. Yeah, so that's where, like, that's why I think this particular plot is important, or this is kind of there. I mean, we would expect to see probably some non-Gaussianity over here if, like, as you're saying, like, these sub-threshold glitches would be there. Yeah, like, yeah. So from there, you can have an understanding about, like, you can, like, and have a better understanding of the noise statistics as well. And yeah, I've not thought about how to deal with like sub-threshold glitches that might like give you a non-Gaussian tail in this distribution. But yeah, I mean, this is like a, this opens up the possibility of actually addressing those things probably.
The main advantage is that the glitches would be happening in different detectors independently of each other. So there's no reason that it would happen at the same time at both detectors.
Yeah.
Except for that, there is this. There is some correlated magnitude. The magnitude.
Yeah, it's some resonance, Schumann's resonance. Yeah. So that's why, like, I was showing this, like, noise statistic. So this we are just taking the mean, but you can actually do, let's say, compute the median or some like other statistics from this distribution. So that actually might help to address those questions, but we have not explored those things yet. But there are possibilities because you have this distribution. So you can do more than just take the mean of that and subtract it from the correlation, like the cross-correlation. But yeah, I mean, these are like open questions for us as well, like trying to explore those.
Other questions?
Yeah, I mean, here we randomize the distribution, the sky distribution parameters like polarization and these parameters. I mean, for the mock data set that we took, we just assumed a uniform distribution given what the upper and lower bounds are for those parameters. But in a way, they would matter because the distribution, like the distribution of the sources kind of would dictate what time lag you have between like detected events in individual like detectors. And that kind of changes what your width like spread in the cross correlation is, like especially your delta T spread is. I mean, the reason why you have a spread in delta T, like other than, I mean, around zero, is because of these time delays. I mean, when you're cross-correlating, so it's not exactly overlapping at, like all of the waveforms are not exactly overlapping at delta T equals to zero. So yeah, I mean, based on this delta T spread, you can possibly, again, parameterize or have an understanding of how the distribution, like the spatial distribution of the events are. But sorry, just to add one more thing, but like that's why like in for the parameter estimation study that we are saying that we are kind of trying to do now. So these are the advantages, because if you do a power spectrum analysis, there you do not have anything which is sensitive to, let's say, these kind of things, like the spatial distribution of the sources, or you cannot quantify it or visually see it. But here, for example, you can see from the spread in delta T that, okay, like these are how like events are distributed or like how it's sensitive to it. So you can like probe more into that. So yeah, that's it.
Okay, but if there are no other questions, then let's thank Ramit again.